Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. When we get into discussion after a while, I was reminded, and I'm going to ask the rest of you to remind me, that if questions don't always pick up here, that either you say them loudly or I will try to repeat them so we can catch that later on. I want to get that in front of you so that we don't miss it later on. This is a session that I entitled The Red Balloon and Other Annoying Tales, and it's an effort to talk about truth in parable and story. I'll get the apology out of the way first. I've never done this session before. This is a first, and I hope you'll help me in it. I'm supposed to be Will Hertzfeldt. It was our hope and plan that he would be. He said he would be here Wednesday, but he'll be here when he's ready to be here, which is the way Will does things. Look forward to his coming. I thought what I'd do is I'd just tell you a number of stories or read them. Some of them I'll read. I don't think I can do too many of them from memory. That's what I would hope to do, because stories and parables really ought to be told rather than read. But I'm working at that, and you'll excuse me if I use some of it out of books. I just have to tell you in advance, they're meant to be annoying. I don't plan to discuss them right away. I would rather just tell you some stories and then just react to that later on and maybe read you some things about them later on that other people have found. The first is a story about the preacher of Dubno, a rabbi, Jacob Krauts. He was once asked why the parable has such persuasive power over people. And the preacher replied, I will explain this by means of a parable. It happened once that truth walked about the streets as naked as his mother bore him. Naturally, people were scandalized, wouldn't let him into their homes, and whoever saw him were frightened and ran away. And so as truth wandered about through the streets looking and brooding over his trouble, he met Parable. Parable was brightly decked out, fine clothes, was a sight to see. Yes, tell me, what's the meaning of all this? Why are you walking around naked and looking so woebegone? Truth shook his head sadly and replied, everything is going downhill for me, brother. I've gotten so old and decrepit that everybody avoids me. Parable said, what you're saying doesn't make any sense. People are not giving you wide berth because you are old. Take me, for instance. I'm no younger than you. Nevertheless, the older I get, the more attractive people find me. Let me tell you a secret about people. They don't like things plain and bare, but dressed up prettily and a little artificial. I'll tell you what. I will lend you some fine clothes like mine, and soon you'll see how people will take to you. And Truth followed this advice and decked himself out in Parable's bright clothes. And lo and behold, people no longer shunned him and but welcomed him heartily. And since that time, Truth and Parable are seen to be inseparable companions, esteemed and loved by all. The Girl with the Red Balloon. Once upon a time, in a little village by the sea, lived a little girl named Lucinda. None of the people in the village called her Lucinda. They called her that girl with the red balloon. Lucinda always carried a bright red balloon, which was tied to a long silver string clutched tightly in her hand. Many of the people in the village laughed at Lucinda and her red balloon. Lucinda was just a little girl, however, and it was perfectly acceptable for small children to play with red balloons. When she was very little, Lucinda tried to explain about her red balloon. For instance, the red balloon was good for leading her somewhere, to beautiful fields, to the ocean, crashing waves, to a warm place where Lucinda felt love. But the balloon could also lead the girl to dark, mysterious caves, which frightened her, or sad forests of grief, which made her cry, or into the midst of quarrels. Then she felt great anger, but it all went together. The red balloon was also excellent for seeing. If she looked at her village, her friends, or the forest through the red balloon, she saw things that others did not see. In the beginning, Lucinda tried to tell others about what she saw. They laughed, and Lucinda learned not to explain about her red balloon. Lucinda was as happy as could be expected, until one day someone said, "Lucinda, you're too old for a red balloon. It was okay when you were a little girl, but now you're almost a woman. You must let that stupid balloon go and be mature." Lucinda held on tighter and tighter, but life became more and more difficult. One particularly difficult day, people were saying things like, "You're always over-dramatizing with that stupid red balloon in your hand. If you let go of that ridiculous red balloon, you might accomplish something." Lucinda then made a decision. She knew she had to keep the red balloon, but she had to hide it. But the question was, where? It had to be close to her, but it had to be well hidden. So she hid the balloon inside her head. And while this hiding place fit the criteria for closeness and secrecy, it had its disadvantages. It gave her a terrible headache. It was very difficult as well to laugh and shake one's head with a red balloon stuffed inside. It was also difficult to cry or to be afraid or even to get angry. There was danger of the balloon popping out and being lost or discovered. To keep the balloon from doing this, Lucinda had to scrunch up her eyes, and seeing became very difficult. So while the balloon was close, it was no longer useful for leading and for seeing. People did stop laughing, and they complimented Lucinda on her new adulthood. She got married, had babies, even went to work at an important job in the village. Her headache got progressively worse, and she almost forgot about flowers and waves and warm places and caves and forests and seeing things through the red balloon. One day, while watching her children through scrunched up eyes, she thought she saw something familiar in the hand of one of them. She tried and tried to see what it was, but she knew that if she was really to see, she would have to open wide her eyes. She knew what would happen if she did, but being a good mother and not wanting her child to have anything harmful, she opened her eyes. And just as she saw a red balloon on a silver string in the hand of her child, she cried out, and out popped her own red balloon. It looked so beautiful and felt so good not to have the balloon in her head anymore. She could see again, and everything appeared as so new. So Lucinda decided to leave the balloon out in the open on its silver string. She laughed and laughed and laughed. Lucinda did not live happily ever after. People now laugh at her and call her spacey and childish and tell her she has no common sense. The red balloon does not always lead Lucinda to beautiful fields of flowers. Dark caves are also there, as well as sad forests and quarrels. When she looks through the red balloon, she does not always see beauty and happiness. But Lucinda did live truly ever after. A person who has influenced me, obviously, and many of us today in dealing with stories and parables is Sally Mafeig Tussell, and now she's divorced, and so her latest book is Sally Mafeig. She quotes Kafka for a parable. "It was very early in the morning, the streets cleaned and deserted. I was on my way to the railroad station. As I compared the tower clock with my watch, I realized it was already much later than I had thought. I had to hurry. The shock of this discovery made me feel uncertain of my way. I was not very well acquainted with the town as yet. Fortunately, there was a policeman nearby. I ran to him and breathlessly asked the way. He smiled and said, 'For me, you want to learn the way?' 'Yes,' I said, 'since I cannot find it myself.' 'Give it up. Give it up,' he said, and turned away with a great sweep, like someone who wants to be alone with his laughter." one that I hope won't be more offensive, indeed ought to be annoying. It's a story from Romulus Limni in Jesus Tales on how St. Peter got bald. St. Peter loved Jesus, but the Basque Country Spaniard, said the Basque Country Spaniard, but he didn't always understand him. One time they were traveling here in Spain, they walked up and down roads, the dust spreading out from their heels, naming towns, founding churches, baptizing babies, and doing good. Early one morning, they passed a farmer on the road. His wagon had hit something and tipped over on its side. His vegetables, his wheat, his wine kegs, cheese gourds, and everything lay spilled out over the road and into the ditch. It was a mess. But this farmer, he was calm about it. He was a big, fat fellow who just wasn't going to let himself get upset the way his wagon was. So instead, he was down on his knees in a very relaxed way. His hands were clasped together. His eyes were closed. He was praying. "Lord Jesus," he was saying, not very loud. He certainly couldn't see Jesus and St. Peter coming up behind him or knew that they were there. "This is just what I deserved," he said. "I am a careless, miserable sinner. I could have seen that big rock in the middle of the road, but I wasn't watching. But I'm not going to feel bad about it. I'm going to be grateful for all the good things that have happened to me. Praise God." St. Peter was impressed. What a healthy human attitude, humble attitude, he said to the Lord. "Let's give him a hand and get all his goods back in his wagon." Jesus looked straight ahead. "Keep walking," he said. "But Lord," said St. Peter. "Hush," said Jesus. They walked right past this unfortunate man, right on down the road. St. Peter kept looking back until Jesus told him to stop it. They didn't get very far until they came upon the same sight all over again. Another wagon was in the ditch. This time a whole side of the wagon was smashed in. There was a big load of hay and wood thrown every which way. This farmer was on his knees too, but he wasn't praying. He was swearing. He had one bony shoulder jammed under one side of his wagon bed, trying to rock the wagon up out of the ditch. He was swearing and he was sweating and straining and swearing, and he couldn't do it. This was a tough, stringy fellow. Scars on his face and hands, a long, crooked nose, all squashed and damaged looking. And that swearing. St. Peter was dismayed. The man sending one evil curse out after another upon the innocent world. It didn't even make sense, thought St. Peter, being about high roads that are manure and hay wagons that slept with their mothers. But it put St. Peter off. "Don't stop," he whispered to Jesus. Jesus stopped. "Lord, we better leave this man alone." Jesus stood right by him, looking down. "What are you doing?" said Jesus. The farmer sat back in his heels, scowling. He wiped sweat out of his eyes. "The hell do you mean, what am I doing? What does it look like?" "In trouble, eh?" That farmer got up slowly, lean and stringy, but big and mean. "If I am, I don't need you to tell me. Get moving." And he cursed Jesus roundly. St. Peter didn't believe what he saw. Jesus socked the farmer. He hauled off and belted him, knocked him flat. The Lord Jesus Christ did that. St. Peter knew it couldn't happen. If Jesus said it once, he said it 1,000 times, "Don't hit other people, just don't." But here he laid this farmer out cold. St. Peter put a hand over his face and shook his head. And when he looked again, he saw Jesus down on one knee. He was fitting one end of his little walking stick under the wagon bed. And Jesus glanced at the knocked-out farmer and chuckled. He stood up, pulling on his little stick. The wagon rocked up out of the ditch. It rolled onto the road and stopped. It stood right side up, axle straight. There wasn't a mark on the side that was smashed. All the wooden hay was back where it had been. "There," said Jesus. He walked off down the road. St. Peter stared at the wagon and the sleeping farmer. He ran after Jesus. who didn't want to talk about it. Another favorite of mine, of course, is Frederick Buechner. And a couple of board members have heard this story, read this story in my report to them because I used it there. In a book that just came out recently called, the book is entitled Room Called Remember, and the very first story in it is about that. I'll just share the story with you. He spends more time talking about it. He talks about having dreams. Several years ago, and how certain dreams really stick. Several years ago, I had such a dream, and it is still extraordinarily fresh in my mind. I dreamt that I was staying in a hotel somewhere, and that the room I was given was a room that I loved. I no longer have any clear picture of what that room looked like, and even in the dream itself, I think it wasn't so much the way the room looked that pleased me as the way it made me feel. It was a room where I felt happy and at peace, where everything seemed the way it should be, and everything about myself seemed the way it should be too. Then as the dream went on, I wandered off to other places and did other things, and finally, after many adventures, ended back at the same hotel again. Only this time I was given a different room, which I didn't feel comfortable in at all. It seemed dark, cramped, and I felt dark and cramped in it. So I made my way down to the man at the desk and told him my problem. In my earlier visit, I said I had this marvelous room which was just right for me in every way and which I'd very much like, if possible, to have again. The trouble, I explained, is that I hadn't kept track of where the room was and I didn't know how to find it or how to ask for it. The clerk was very understanding. He said he knew exactly the room that I meant and that I could have it again any time I wanted it. All I had to do, he said, was ask for it by name. So then, of course, I asked him what the name of the room was. He would be happy to tell me, he said, and then he told me. The name of the room, he said, was Remember. This will be the last. I got a couple more, but let me just share this one. A little bit longer. This is from Robert Farrar Capon, who has a book that deals with fable, analogies, proofs, words, images, all kinds of things. This is under fable. I guess this might be my favorite, but it's a little long. Once upon a time, in the mud at the bottom of a tidal pool, there lived an oyster. By oyster standards, he had a good life. The seawater was clean and full of plankton, and the green warmth of the light at low tide made him grow and prosper. Next to him lived a stone, with whom he sometimes talked. It was very much the same size, shape, and color as he, and was good, if undemanding, company. As a matter of fact, their conversations gave the oyster a definite feeling of superiority. He loved to dwell at length on the differences that underlay their apparent similarity. Rocks, he would say, are merely mineral. Oysters may be mineral on the outside, but inside they are bona fide members of the animal kingdom. One day, however, the stone surprised him by coming up with a rejoinder. It pointed out that there were nevertheless some advantages by being further down the evolutionary scale. Rocks had fewer enemies than oysters. Starfish and oyster drills, he had observed, were no threat to stones. To the oyster, they were a matter of life and death. Furthermore, the stone told him it was just getting a little tired of being put down by oysters with hairs. You might get a lesson in humility if you listen to some of the things starfish say about oysters, things which the oyster never heard because he was too busy being mortally afraid, but which the stone heard regularly and with amusement. Starfish, it seems, have a very low opinion of oysters. They eat them, but they always refer to them as nothing more than a rock with a stomach. In fact, what passes for humor among starfish is rather like Polish jokes, except that the punchline invariably has to do how stupid it is to be an animal and not to be able to move about. The worst thing one starfish can call another is a sessile creature. The oyster terminated the discussion huffily and went into a state of profound depression. To have everything, to
to have everything he had been so proud of become the butt of underwater ethnic wisecracks made life not worth living. Existence, he concluded, was nothing but a cruel joke. All the faith he once had in the grand design and the evolutionary scheme forsook him. Better to believe in nothing than dignify this farce of a world with pretensions of order. He became an anti-evolutionist and stopped saying his prayers. For a while, righteous indignation made the losing of his religion rather fun, as it always does. But as summer wore on into fall and the water began its slow progress to winter's cold, he became merely sour, angry at the universe, but even more angry with himself for having let it turn him into a grouch. Finally, in desperation, he decided he would pray once again, but this time with a difference. No more mumbling of set pieties. He saw himself as a Job among oysters. He would open his shell and curse his day. And the oyster spoke and said, "Let the day perish wherein I was spawned, and the night in which it was said a seed oyster has appeared. Why is light given to him that in misery and that is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul? Why do I live my days in doubt and darkness? Oh, that one would hear me and tell me openly of the glories above. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me." And to his utter astonishment, a voice said, all right, but I have to make it short. It's Friday afternoon." "It's all true. There are things you never, ever dreamed of," said the voice. "All kinds of stuff, and with moves you couldn't even imagine if you tried. As a matter of fact, that's your problem. There you sit with a rock on one side and a starfish on the other. My apologies, it's a limited field of vision, I admit. But in the evolutionary scale business, you've got to put a lot of things near the bottom. Spoils the effect if you don't. Anyway, the moves, I'll tell you a few. Basketball, college basketball, especially. The best ones are so flashy, they make you laugh for not being able to believe the guy actually made the shot. And squirrels going through trees, one of my best effects. You know the last time a squirrel missed his footing? I keep track of these things. It was May 3rd, 1438, definitely a record. And it's not all slapdash either. I've got creatures so graceful, they almost break your heart. When it comes to exquisite moves, my favorite maybe is girls' knees. Lovely. Some people think that's a funny thing to get excited about, but in this line of work, there's no substitute for enthusiasm. Seriously, if you take the knee thing and really go all the way with it, you get my absolute favorite for loveliness, a prima ballerina. Talk about moves. It's like Ernie DiGiorgio, Marcel Marceau, and Squirrel Nutkin all roll together, but as a girl. Which makes it much better. Terrific. Listen, though. It's almost sundown. I have to set a good example. As I said, your basic problem is your point of view. There really are all these great moves, but you unfortunately don't know from motion. If you're going into the business as the world's first philosophical oyster, it's okay by me. But just so you shouldn't get it all wrong, I'll give you one piece of advice. Think very carefully. Remember that all this stuff really is, but it can't possibly be the way you think, or to turn it around, the way you think about things will never be exactly the same as the way they are. But enough. I really have to run. Mazel tov. One of the problems with telling stories and using illustrations and parables is that they are, trite, I don't know if I want to use that word, but it's the only one that comes to mind, trite definition we have of a parable, earthly story with a heavenly meaning. It really doesn't tell you a lot. To sell makes a very strong point that that's really not adequate. When she talks about the parable by Kafka, the one of the policemen, she says, the parable by Kafka seems at first reading to invite interpretation, in fact, to insist on it. one can immediately think of autobiographical, psychological, and theological interpretations, which may make sense out of it. But to attempt such interpretations would be to allegorize it, or to treat it as an illustration or an embellishment of what we already know, as all interpretations do. In fact, fall flat. They are far less interesting than the story itself. And even though they may comfort us for a while with the supposition that we now understand the parable, we find ourselves returning again and again to the story, unsatisfied with any interpretation. The parable appears to be more and other than any interpretation. This is so because Kafka's parable is a genuine one. It is not translatable or reducible. It is also an excellent parable to ponder because, if anything, it is even less translatable than biblical parables, while manifesting many of the same central qualities. What Sisela is saying here and elsewhere, it seems to me, is that parables, when they're real parables, deal with what is unknown, not with what is known. And in the early part of her book, she makes a very strong statement that parable is the way humans really move. It deals with the whole of the self inside. That's why I contend that parables and storytelling is really for laity. Now, it sounds highfalutin at times, but I think that the uninitiated theologically, by that I mean you haven't taken systematics and exegesis and all those other things, perhaps have a better grasp on a story, even and especially when you can't tell someone else what it means, than people who might have theological training. Our use of stories tend to be that they must be precise and fit into a category, and then we say, oh, now I understand it, and then we think we have learned. But when the story doesn't say that and causes you to continue to struggle with it and study it and look at whatever it is again and again, then it might be a good parable. The sower went out to sow seed, or the tares among the wheat. After you've made the very logical explanations, well, let's take sower and the seed. Seed goes here, seed goes there, and that. And the seed is this, and that is that. Still doesn't tell you a lot about the story. Why doesn't the seed work in stony ground if the seed is as great as we believe it is? Why is it only some places that the seed bears fruit 100-fold? The story isn't there. The parable doesn't tell you. And it seems to me the essential question after that story is, I want to know why that seed is so different in different places. Same seed. Or why is it dependent on external factors, that the rain might come and wash it away, or the sun might bloom too strongly and destroy it? How come? No answer in the story. It's a good parable. I purposely didn't tell you about Romulus Limni. This is a book of parables that he, or stories that he tells, that he discovered by working with people in backwoodsy cultures, and try to eke out stories that were told. Many stories, like the one he told where Jesus knocks the guy out, were the stories that the common people evolved in order to deal with divinity. They couldn't hack it. It was too good. It was too foreign. And so they made up their own stories. They didn't come from church. They didn't get the priests going around telling that story. But they made up their own in order to, if you will, accommodate to what they saw as the overwhelming power of God in creation and in the church. We could sit around and say, that's good and that's bad. And I would invite any of that kind of discussion. But I would only advance that if he's right, and I have no reason to doubt him, at the moment anyway, then it happened. And then the question is how many parables that we make up to make things adjust to our way, or stories, or views, or images, probably more images than anything else. Well, I'll be willing to stop there for a little bit, and got other stories to read if we run out of things to say, but be glad to see if you have any responses or questions or comments or additions.
That one, my talk was so short and slipped right by. Could you just quickly do that?
Sure. Here. No. Here. It was very early in the morning. The streets clean and deserted. I was on my way to the railroad station. As I compared the tower clock with my watch, I realized it was already much later than I had thought, and I had to hurry. The shock of this discovery made me feel uncertain of my way. I was not very well acquainted with the town as yet, but fortunately there was a policeman nearby. I ran to him and breathlessly asked him the way. He smiled and said, "For me, you want to learn the way?" "Yes," I said, "since I can't find it myself." Give it up, he said, and turned away with a great sweep, like someone who wants to be alone with his laughter.
Elmer?
Yeah.
It seems to me that we have a real problem with parables in our modern world, because of our scientific worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Your illustration of the seed, the sowing of the seed, you know, every time you said we don't have an answer for that, I had an answer,
mm-hmm.
a scientific answer,
mm-hmm.
that you're right, ultimately doesn't satisfy. But I'm wondering, Can you say something about how parables fit into our world today, when we seem to have all the answers to why things happen?
Well, first, I don't think we have all the answers to why things happen, and I'm a scientist.
Would it be fair for you to translate, and you have to say whether it's fair, to translate what you said, we have a lot more answers than we used to have about certain things.
Sure.
I think that's sort
we
of
have
fair.
A lot more questions,
though. Farmers in Jesus' day would have known, had the same scientific, much of the same scientific answer as to why the seed didn't grow on rocky ground.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that isn't a great mystery,
mm-hmm.
but it's the underneath questions. That,
right.
Yeah.
It's if the parable was about it, he wasn't giving him a lesson in agronomy.
No.
They knew that. But what remained unanswered is why, whatever it is, the scientific, quote, scientific answer is why that seed doesn't grow. What does that say about the word,
yeah.
which is what he was talking about? That's the answer that remains unsaid. But I think his question is still a good one about how we treat parabolic thinking and speaking. So I'd invite any more response. One good response was we don't know everything. That's a good starting point.
Another way is to think of it that a lot of scientific explanation perhaps is parable, because it is only hypothesis. Some truth is really indescribable. Science is that you make observations and based on those observations, you can predict how something will come out if you, again, can repeat the same observations.
Mm-hmm.
But how it is really all put together is beyond us. And so maybe a lot of scientific explanation is simply a parable, and someday will be recognized as that. Just as
I have a story I use in sermons I did here not long ago by Lewis Thomas, just this week, last week, I guess, in which scientific research is totally dependent on mistakes. Yeah, and he says, what Lewis doesn't say, but why I think he writes in parables, he says, profound essayist. If you like the form of the essay itself, marvelous, just we taste it so marvelous. But what he doesn't say in his essay, of course, is, isn't that really true? I mean, about all of life. And it gets away from the emphasis on of sin being all only mistake. You know, sin, I think, is being destructive to life with God or life with someone else. It's much more than a mistake. And so, I mean, he allows for, in fact, the importance of mistakes in all kinds of things. But then that would force us, who are thinking theologically about what he's writing, and that's always unfair to do, I mean, to force him. That's Garrison Keillor. I assume most of you know Garrison Keillor from Prairie Home Companion. He spoke recently, as I'm sure he has other places too, in St. Paul, Minneapolis. I think at Augsburg College. And to a large group of Lutheran clergymen. And my son happened to be able to sit in on that and said one of his first things was to thank all the Lutheran clergymen who were carefully interpreting his stories as theological essays. And what he was saying to them was, I just tell stories, that's all I do. But they were interpreting like that, which we all do. That's another story. Do you any remember his story of the storm house? Oh, what a marvelous story. I can't do it, let me tell you briefly. I'll tell you as much as I can remember. When he was growing up, he lived outside of town. And one of the advantages of living outside of town was that you were assigned a storm house. Meaning that if the snow came during the day, you couldn't get back out to your farm. The buses wouldn't go. And so you had to go to some place in town. And so he was given this house, and I forget the name of the people, he knew the name of the people as well. And so he would walk by the house and described gorgeously, beautifully, how it looked, everything that was there. And then he would lie in bed at night thinking about what it would be like to come to the door one day when they had a storm, and then somebody would say in a Norwegian accent, which I can't do, "Oh, the snow kid is, the storm kid is here, come on in." And then they would make him some hot chocolate, and they would have the breakfast in the morning would be, and he just reveled in this. And then ends up by saying that winter, all of the snows came at night. Never got to go to my storm house. But isn't it nice to have a storm house to go to? Oh, wow, I love that. He may not have been thinking or talking theologically, but I'm suspicious.
I am too.
Yes.
And a beautiful garden outside.
Oh yeah, the description of the flowers, the terrace, yeah, and the fence, marvelous.
I don't know what relevance this even has, but that your comment that parables were for laity, even more so for children. You think back, oh, the parables, you didn't ask about them when you were little, and I have some little arch books for my kids. They always pick the parables. Don't ask, you know, what's going on here or why. They just sit and listen to them.
Well, the other night, the same night as you read from Lewis Thomas, who is an interesting fellow, he also introduced us to Wigner.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, under parable, which sort of shakes me up, with parables and jokes both, if you've got to have it explained, don't bother. And I wondered, you know, when the parables were to confuse the unbeliever. Mm-hmm. I guess, didn't Jesus say something like that?
Mm-hmm.
But and you brought up that the people there, in that situation, the believers understood, didn't they? And like the same thing when Jesus texts the farmer.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose those people maybe understood that.
Oh, I think so.
It's out of that culture too. You have to become one of them to understand them. I don't know.
Leo put his finger on another frustration of mine. As a preacher, so many of the times the text I've given is a parable, and after I get done reading it, I don't like to say any more. It's just to violate it. But yet I'm supposed to spend another 10 minutes or whatever doing something like that. Did you ever have that feeling?
Oh my, yes.
What did you do with it?
Did what all preachers do, try to explain it. when you get older and maybe a little wiser, you try to tell stories about it rather than explain it. That reminds me, though, when I years ago preached Bainton's Luke Christmas sermons, and at an Advent service in Park Forest, I lifted one of them, told them that's what I was doing, you know, and it was marvelous. And at the door going out, at the church, and one woman came up to me and shook my hand, thanked me, says, "With stuff like that around, why do you guys bother?" Of course, Roland told, you know, he used to come here a lot. He died just shortly before my wife. Roland told Ginny, when he was here for early on for a reunion with his family, and when the family left, the one daughter came to Ginny. They had seen that Ginny and Roland got along pretty well. They said, "You take care of Grandpa for us, will you?" So she chatted with him quite a bit, and then he told her that his wife, who had died about 3 years before, had always suspicioned that those were not all Luther. That there was a dose of Bainton in those sermons. she would say, "Roland, did Luther really say all that, or did you make that up?" And he said, "I never answered her." I think it's a lovely story. To Sell's later book, after speaking in parables, was metaphorical theology, which I bumped into from Ellen Gamrath, which I think is intriguing and difficult, and goes so far, if you don't mind going even further, to treat Jesus Christ as a metaphor. So you see where you go and where you have to have your limits and your understanding pretty worked out. So interesting. We are still, we're beginning to get the influence of feminine theology, of what I would say for to sell American theology. So many of our theologians, and I, some of my best friends are these, were trained in Europe, and I still think bring us a somewhat impregnated, European impregnated theology. And I don't mean to say better or worse, but different. And I think the women gathering in our country who are doing now some very creative theological thinking, always had been, but now are putting it in print, are going to be influencing us in ways that eventually we will have to deal with. You know, another 40 years, people may be talking about that in a casual way. Today would be terribly upsetting to most people. Interesting person. We tried to get her at a staff conference for Lutheran Campus Ministry, and it was right after, you know, she had done this and had spoken all over the country. She says, "I'm absolutely worn out. I don't know anything except what's in that book. I'm taking 2 years to go learn." And I just, that's kind of respect that, and a little different, frankly, than most of many of us males that went to find out something to say, and obviously she had more to say when she got to the next book. Others? Responses? Yes?
We read a book in a couples group that we're in called God on Our Minds. Anyway, it's a really neat book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's lay people and clergy gathered together for a number of summers to talk about their own faith, mm-hmm. using only their personal experiences and their own, you know, don't quote Tillich or whoever, just say what it is inside you. And one of the quotes from one of the people who was there was about seeing Jesus as parable and his life, death, and resurrection as the parable of God's love for us. It was much longer than that, but it just, it, you know, really struck me. It just said.
Jesus is God's parable to his people. Mm-hmm. So that was...
What annoys me as an ordained clergyman, therefore, and some of, you know, I'm very sympathetic and empathetic and even, you know, even strong supportive feelings for ordained clergy. And what I'm going to say may sound that I don't, but I do. I have very strong feelings, but I think that they themselves and others have done them in a way that is tragic in our society. And I'd be glad to talk about that another time. But I, having said that, I am envious of what I suspect is the depth of understanding about God and about life and the world that is rarely transmitted to others. And what I'm learning, what I think I may be learning, is that maybe it shouldn't be or doesn't have to be. I have such a need to hear how other people in totally different worlds put it all together, whatever that means, like this person is doing. And that kind of a group might be one of the entrees to it as well. And I'm not saying this toss away everything else. I think a lot of the marvelous, if you will permit it to that, theology that comes grew out of all kinds of things. Somebody discussed the other night, why do we always have to say the Apostles' Creed? This was in reaction to the other night. Just saying, I'm not sure I believe it. And I think, you know, or that it's worth a good, worth that much time in the service when it speaks so little, these people were saying to me, about today's life. It seems to be so way out there. And yet I believe that some of that, whatever it may be, is what enables the kinds of things that happen. And I can put up, well, I have a strong commitment to the liturgical life, so I can put up lots of things that might be repeated, dull, you know, repetitious and dull and boring in one sense, but which I think spin off. That the word that George Hoyer uses, he's a liturgical scholar, is polysemous. Polysemous simply mean many meanings. Just has many meanings. Oh God, from whom all holy desires, all good counsels, and all just works do proceed. Now, what do you think of? A whole raft of things. Give unto your servants that peace which the world cannot give. What does that mean to the person who's struggling with guilt What does it mean to the person who is struggling with cancer? What does it mean to the person who is struggling with kids? There's a whole raft of meanings. It's polysemous language. When it's polysemous, it seems to me, then it just stirs it up. And the other advantage is that people do their own worship in church anyway. Rarely has much to do with what's going on. You preach your heart off, and they hear you were going this way, and they hear way over here. And that's great.
This is a long way from parable, but the use of liturgy and repetition sprung this to mind. Some years ago, there was a series, I think it was on public TV, called The Long Search.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And I remember his interviewing an Orthodox Jew about why he strapped on the prayer box every morning.
Sure.
And he said that it's because that when that day comes when I really need to cry out, I don't know how. And that really meant a lot to me.
Sure.
Because
sure.
If you don't have that, you won't know how.
Why, for public statement about Holden, why we do start the day with the scriptures and study the word and then trust God. You know, we don't have to plug in, we can anytime anybody wants to pray, stop, read, whatever one wants to do, but we don't feel then obligated that we must now at every moment stop and have a prayer. And it sounds like somebody's downplaying prayer, which I wouldn't at all, but I think it's upplaying the kind of prayer that goes on all the time and ought, which is a sensitivity with the presence and power of God in all of our life, for us because of Jesus Christ. But starting at that point, and it might be prosaic, or it might be controversial, or whatever it may be, but it's the whole business, no matter what you hear during that time, or even if you don't come, you know that that's the place we believe you ought to start. And then let it go for the day. It's that trust in the Spirit. That's Spirit-led for me. I don't mean it's the only way. Certainly other ways of sensing and believing the Spirit. But that's addressing it. And I think that's what we do. Well, Luther, in his crazy kind of world that he lived in, how would you like to have had his schedule, would say when you get up in the morning, cross yourself and say, and then say that tiny little prayer that he had, and then get about your work. This is the kind of style he had. I think we imitate
it. The rootedness and the givens are what give you the freedom. Because if you just have the other, then it doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if in this place, worship has so many different forms,
mm-hmm.
in that freedom, that you're doing your task, whether it's dumping garbage or whatever, it's a totality.
Indeed.
And when we fragment it or break it off, the prayer alone is
mm-hmm.
Thankfulness to God or worship.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, that's what this place has meant to me.
Well, you said something about the secular the other night.
Sure.
It was very helpful. You know, thank you. To repeat that, because we learned so much on this. And you mentioned Garrison Keillor on Prayer mm-hmm. Home Companion. I'll never forget the most memorable movie I've ever seen here. It's Gigo. And a lot of people didn't go to it because Jackie Gleason was the
yeah.
primary actor. Yet it had remarkable theological significance. And I keep wondering, you know, was it really intended?
Yeah.
But this fellow, that he had played the part of one who couldn't speak.
Mm.
And he was very compassionate, and he took his wife. And in a moment of not remembering, he always fell into whenever there was a funeral procession, he'd fall into it and start crying with the people.
Wow.
He left the wave outside the cathedral, and then he remembered her, and he ran back to the cathedral, and she was playing in the holy water.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to tell her what happened in this cathedral, you see, and then he took her up to the crucifix. There he is, trying to tell her what all this means. And then he starts pounding his mouth in frustration because he cannot tell her the story, which is all of our problems, you see? But you go back to the secular, I think, and address this also, what I just heard from Alan.
Mm-hmm. And in that modeling here, is what we're hoping people carry back there. Not that it's the first idea you have never had that idea. That would be terrible frustrating to think that way. But that it reinforces, yeah, we believe that's the way it is too. And we want to encourage it. In that sense, this is really a place apart in order to renew the ministry of the laity, the ministry of the people of God, wherever it is. It isn't that we sit here and say, well, you ought to do this, you ought to do that, you ought to do this. It was affirming that everything you are doing is connected to that. We're trying in small ways and in perfect ways to model it. And I rejoice in it, and I think that's great, great fun.
And even that the parables are not self-consciously religious. No, that no. is what makes them, that's what gives them their power mm-hmm. to me.
Sure.
So we get so locked into those other
correct.
Patterns. Like Leo says, a movie, sometimes, and that speaks, that breaks down those barriers that sure. people have against religion, so that when you tell it, it just breaks through to me and to everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why C.S. Lewis wrote the way he did, because
mm-hmm.
that's the only way he could reach some of the people that would otherwise not read. Or I've done a reading here, and I may do it again, on the Leo the Lion that shot back.
Hmm.
On the line, you know, it was Shel Silverstein. Huh?
Yeah.
I mean, he's on the last guy. The last guy in line. You know? He also, I think, wrote The Giving Tree.
Yeah.
Great, great significance. And in fact, I haven't talked to Dan Otto. I got to remember to do that, because after I read it here the first time, he was about the first time in the village. And he said he had a Swedish congregation in the Twin Cities or somewhere there, and he wanted a copy of it. He's going to give it for the Sunday sermon.
Mm.
And he shortly left thereafter, and I don't know if that's why or not. I don't know. But it has great significance about this lion that didn't know whether he was a lion or a human, you know.
Great.
And the sad part of it is, somebody sent it to me who was really searching, and he signed it Lafcadio, the lion that shot back. Excuse me.
All right.
People always call me Leo the Lion. I'm
back here.
Lafcadio.
The Peanuts cartoons.
Of course.
Are parables that kids sure. and adults read, stories, theology, I think, all the
sure.
time.
Sure.
Good theology.
Right. Lots. The time's up. Thanks very much.
Thank you.